So today we're going to be talking with Rabbi Shmuel Heineman. Rabbi Shmuel Heineman is the head of the Starkey office in New York, New Jersey. He is a brother to Rav Moshe Heineman, who is our rabbinic administrator. And Rabbi Shmuel Heineman has been with the Starkey for over 25 years, almost 27 years now, and he has expertise in all areas of the kosher world. The area we'll speak about today is the meat and poultry. He has experience in catering, in restaurants, in factory production, and many of us here at the Starkey turn to Rabbi Shmuel Heineman for advice, for questions, and that goes true as well for people outside of the Starkey. So we're very pleased to have Rabbi Heineman take out time from his busy schedule to join us. Good afternoon, Rabbi Heineman.
Good afternoon, Rabbi Goldberg. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad that we can spend some time talking about the more the kosher than meets the eye, which is a great title. And I have to say that was your idea for the title. I have to give you credit, Rabbi Heineman. Tell us a little bit about your experience and background in the meat industry, in the shechita, in the slaughtering. And so we'll start off with that, give people an idea of where you're coming from.
Okay, when I started with the Starkey, it was about 28 years ago. At that time, the Starkey was giving hashgacha to Falls Poultry in Livingston Manor, New York. This was our first or our second place the Starkey was giving hashgacha on poultry. That plant is not operating anymore, but at that time I was asked to help out the Starkey to supervise that plant. I would go up on a regular basis and check the plant, check the shechtim, their knives, and I continued doing that for about 13 years until the plant closed, which was about 14 years ago. That was the plant where the Galul name was first introduced into the market.
I wonder, Rabbi Heineman, how many of our listeners remember the Galul, because it's been a while, right?
Right, yeah, I'm saying it's been the plant closed about 14 years ago. It was bought out by Empire Kosher
Poultry. That's right.
And it's on and off every once in a while. I think right now they're not producing under the Galul name, but now, just recently, Empire has taken on the certification of the Starkey, in addition to the OU that was there before, and the products are already appearing on the market with the Starkey on the Empire poultry.
So we can get Empire-branded Starkey meat?
We can get, right now, this just happened, this is the latest breaking news, it's maybe a week old, where the Starkey is, you can find the Starkey on retail packs of meat. It's not listed under the Empire name, just because Empire Beef is owned, that name is owned by a different company, but they're marketing their beef under the name EKB Beef, which really stands for Empire Kosher Beef, and that product is on the market with the Starkey.
Right. So it's EKB as opposed to the Empire, but it's the same idea.
It's owned by the same company.
Same company, right. Where should we start? There's so much to talk about in the meat. Let me start with this question that we got, Rabbi Heineman. One of our listeners sent in this question. He says, from what I recall, galat is a chumra, meaning astringency. If so, why is it that almost all meat sold today is called glot? Or is it that non-glot meat is being sold as glot? So get right down into the meat of the issue. What is the difference between glot and non-glot, and why is everything seeming to be glot nowadays?
Okay, let me give you a little background on some of the laws of the kosher beef. There are 18 different blemishes, I guess you could call them, on an animal, which if the animal has any of these blemishes or problems, it would render the animal non-kosher. We do not check, after we check the animal, we do not check all fall 18 because most of them are not common problems. But the most common problem in an animal is a problem with the lungs. These are adhesions on the lungs, like pieces of skin that are attached to the lung. And an adhesion on the lung is, our sages tell us, is often indicative of a hole in the lung. A hole in the lung renders the animal non-kosher. So right after the slaughter of the animal, the shochet checks the lungs, and if he finds any adhesions, he has to make sure that there are no holes under those adhesions. He blows up the lungs with a machine, and he puts water there to see if any air is escaping. If any air escapes, that animal is non-kosher. Now, the difference between glatt and regular kosher is, do we actually take off the adhesions to check? The glatt says, that's the opinion of one of the halakhic authorities, says that you do not check. If it has any adhesions, we assume there's a hole there, and even if you check and you find there is no hole, it still is not permissible to use. Others hold of the opinion that if you remove that adhesion very carefully and you check and there is no hole in the lung, so then that is still kosher. So not checking, just if the glatt really means smooth, so if the lung is completely smooth without any adhesions, that makes the animal glatt. If there are adhesions but the adhesions are removed and the animal is still found to be without any holes in the lungs, that would be regular kosher.
What percentage of the kosher animals have the glatt designation?
Okay.
What percentage of the animals are kosher? We're talking about large animals, I guess, right?
Right. We're talking about steers and cows, larger animals.
But what percentage usually would be kosher without being glatt necessarily?
Okay. It really depends on where the animals are coming from and also the breed of animal. There's one breed of animals which a lot of the consumers might be familiar with. It's called Black Angus. That is a breed of animal. It's a black cow, and in that breed we find a higher percentage of glatt. I would say on the average about 30-35%. It does vary. Sometimes it can be only 20, and sometimes it can be 50 or 55% in rare cases. In other breeds of animals, of cows and steers, the percentage is lower, and you sometimes will get only 20%.
But do we know what percentage of the all animals would be kosher without being glatt?
Well, our sages tell us, Chazal tell us, that most animals are kosher. And that really is the criteria why we're allowed to drink milk. Because if the animal is not kosher, the milk is also not kosher. Now, we can't really, every time you want to get a glass of milk, you know, milk the cow and then shecht it to see if the animal is kosher, to see if the milk is kosher, that would make milk very prohibitive and impossible to buy. So what we rely on is the rule of the majority, that in a case where it's not possible to check, which, for example, is with milk, where it's not possible to check, we go after the majority, the rov, and since the majority of the animals are kosher, so therefore, we're allowed to drink the milk. If the animal's in front of us and we already shechted the animal, so we cannot rely on rov because we have to check. But in a situation where it's not possible, so then, for example, drinking milk, so then we rely on the majority of the animals being kosher and we are allowed to drink the milk. The question.
Okay,
is,
but as far as so let's get back to the glatt. So the glatt you're saying is somewhere between 20-35% are glatt.
Right. Correct.
Okay. And then, so why is everything glatt? And why don't you ever go into a store? You don't see regular kosher almost never.
Okay.
It's not where I shop.
Right. Approximately 40 years ago, maybe 45 years ago. Until that time, it was very hard to find glatt meat. The industry was not that big, and all the meat that was sold, even by the reliable agencies, was only regular kosher. at that time, there were some rabbis that felt that it was time or we should try and strive for a higher level of kashrus, and therefore we should go up to the level of glatt. This took many years. One agency at a time would switch over to glatt. The OU for many, many years was did not only give on glatt, they gave on regular kosher. But basically over the years where everybody, where kashrus in America in general has come to a higher level, basically it was accepted that the standard of glatt is the acceptable standard for a higher level of kashrus. And therefore basically all national organizations and reliable organizations have now come to only certifying glatt. There's very little kosher being processed in America since there's not such a market for it.
One of the questions was, is non-glatt being sold as glatt? In other words, the question is implying that he thinks that there may be something fraudulent going on, that the meat that's being sold, marketed as glatt, it really doesn't meet that standard. Do you think is any possibility of that, or is that?
Well, the truth is that what we call glatt is not that the lung is completely smooth and free of adhesions. There are sometimes small little strands, like thread-like adhesions, which are so fine and they come off so easily that we call them glatt. I'm saying that is the standard in the industry. Even every sheet in America and in the world that is selling as glatt accepts these very thin adhesions, which are just like threads, which come off easily without any effort of the shechet. Those are all called glatt.
And even though you're saying technically it doesn't meet the standard of glatt, but the standard of glatt has been broadened. I'm just rephrasing what you're saying, and therefore that's why we're finding everything is glatt, because they lowered the standard a little bit.
Well, they have brought it to standard, but I think that has been in effect from the time 45 years ago when glatt was introduced into the market. That was accepted as glatt already from the beginning. It has not been watered down over the time. It is what the Rabbanim have nowadays, and based on the Peskim, on the earlier responses, that they say that this is also considered glatt because it's not really an adhesion. It just comes right off.
But you are broadening it somewhat, right? In other words,
according to some, that is true. According to some, it might be taking it a little bit further. But I would say just about everyone nowadays, all agencies in Rabbanim, all accept this standard as glatt. And that has been, it's not something new. It's not something new that has happened now. It is something that has been in effect since glatt has been introduced to the American market about 45 years ago.
Right, okay. All right, well, I think that pretty much
The question is really, what you're asking is how come there's so much glatt nowadays, more than there was years ago? Well, the answer is, I think, is because you have a lot of larger companies that are pushing this meat. Until, in the earlier times, years ago, the companies would push more of the non-glatt because that was easy to come by. But now we have a lot of companies that are selling kosher meat, and there's also a bigger market maybe in the glatt kosher market, and therefore you find more glatt kosher. I don't think, it's just that more animals are being geschachna, being slaughtered, and that's why you have more glatt.
Let me just pause for a second for station identification. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg at Star K in Baltimore, and we're speaking with Rabbi Shmuel Heinemann, the Star K offices in New York and New Jersey, talking about glatt kosher. If you have a question and you're joining us through the telephone, hit 1-1 on your keypad, and we'll see that you have a question. If you have a question through the chat on the dim, you can do that also. I see we do have some questions, so behind them, let's take some of those. What's the difference between Glot and Beit Yosef? And what's the difference between Beit Yosef and Lubavitch meat?
Okay. Lubavitch meat just means, it is not really a standard. It just means that the shochet who is doing the slaughtering, he is a Lubavitcher. It does not, is not any standard of what type of, if it's Beit Yosef or Glot or kosher, that doesn't come into the play. It's just all Lubavitch means that there is a Lubavitcher shochet who's doing the shchita.
Okay.
The difference between Beit Yosef and Glot is, as we explained before, that the standard in Glot kosher is that if these adhesions are very thin, like a thread, and they come right off, that's still considered Glot. According to the Beit Yosef standard, that really would not be acceptable. It really has to be completely smooth without any adhesions or any anything connected to the lung, at all.
And what is the percentage of Beit Yosef meat?
The percentage of Beit Yosef, according to the way I just defined it, is about 5%.
So
five,
I would imagine
between 5 and 10%.
Between 5 and 10%.
Right.
So I would imagine there's a great difference in price also.
Well, you know, they try and get a higher price for it, but any distributor, any manufacturer of meat does not only produce Beit Yosef Glot, Beit Yosef, because that would not be profitable. He's doing both. He's doing Beit Yosef, and if it does not qualify for Beit Yosef standard, it will become Glot. And so, therefore, it doesn't really cost him anything extra because the Beit Yosef can be sold either way. And therefore, he's not doesn't have any extra expenditures for to make his Beit Yosef Glot.
Uh-huh. I just want to remind our viewers online that I was moving around on the website to bring up an article. Now, if you want to see the chat, you have to click show chat up there on the right side. So Rabbi Heineman, let me ask you. I know that the Sfardim are more careful with the are careful for, to get Beit Yosef, but I'm an Ashkenazi. Should it be something I should go to my butcher and say, listen, I'd rather get the Beit Yosef meat, you know, since especially you're explaining to me it's not that more expensive. So should I chepper or bother my butcher to get me the Beit Yosef? After all, it's a higher standard. Why not?
Well, you know, it's like anything. If you can, the way we, the meat that we certify and that is used as glat is 100% kosher, and it's fine for Ashkenazim. If someone wants to be machmir, so there's nothing wrong with being machmir. Does is that person also machmir on all the other stringencies that Rambam has over the other, you know, poskim? So then, you know, that might be true if a person always is not. Is
maybe not, but this doesn't cost anymore, so why not?
Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, that there are some people who are machmir like the Rambam, but since we don't paskin like him, we do not, that's not the law.
I mean, over here we have, in Baltimore, we have 7 Mile Market. So what do the Sfardim do? I mean, I go to the store and I just pick up whatever is there lying out in my butcher store. What do the Sfardim do special? They have to go to them, to the butcher there behind the counter and say, give me, you know, pack me Beit Yosef meat. What do they do? Practically speaking.
Okay, well, some of them do that. The ones who want to be very careful do that. However, what has come about now that the Sfarish Paiskim, the Sfarish rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, they really have paskined, and they have decided that what we call glat also is something that the Beis Yosef, who says that it has to be completely smooth, he also would agree to. And that's what a lot of them rely on. So they're relying on that.
Oh, our regular meat meets that standard.
Right.
That's interesting. Okay, very good. We do have a question through the telephone. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I did dial in late. Maybe you answered this. If everything was kosher before glot, why was glot necessary?
Well, kashrus over the years in America has, you know, at the beginning was not so easy to keep kosher. It was not so easy to certify a company as kosher because the companies were not so agreeable. And therefore, certain leniencies had to be relied on. As time went on and more people in sin and cashless, we did away with the leniencies, and now cashless in America is on a very high standard. The same thing was with the meat. Until then, it was people were lying, it was kosher, and people were lying that it was fine, and there was no other meat available. As time went on and people were able to go to a higher level, the rabbis decided that it was time to bring kashrus to a higher level and therefore to only certify a glatt meat.
So you're saying, Rabbi Heinemann, that we're getting back now to the standard that we were on maybe, you know, in Europe 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago?
No,
we're just getting back to the standard that was held all the time, all throughout the ages.
Well, in Europe, it was not glatt was not easily obtainable, and that was because basically you didn't have these big slaughterhouses. You had a butcher in the town, and he would take buy a cow and take it to the sheikhet, and the sheikhet would check it. If that animal was kosher, even if it was not glatt, he took it, because if he didn't, what was he going to do with it? He was stuck with that animal. And
okay,
so
I see what you're saying. Nowadays, if you're in a slaughterhouse, so the you take the 30%, 35% that's kosher, and the other 65% gets sold as non-kosher, so the proprietor doesn't take a loss on it, really.
Well, the distributor doesn't take a loss. The person who owns the slaughterhouse, he really keeps all the non-kosher and also the hindquarters, and he sells it to the non-kosher market.
Right.
So,
there's a market for it. But if you're in a shtetl in Europe, and you have a loss on your cow is not is shechted and it's not kosher, so then basically you're going to lose very much. Therefore, you'd have to rely on certain leniencies. That's what you said.
It was a major financial loss, and so therefore, generally in Europe, most people only ate kosher. They did not eat glatt kosher. It was not readily available. There were very few people who were very strict, and they knew about it, and they would only buy the meat. They would ask the butcher, is this glatt or not? And depending on what he told them, they would buy meat. If it was not glatt kosher, they wouldn't have any meat for a week or two, and sometimes for months, until they would get an animal that was glatt. Here in America, where we don't have that problem, where generally the non-kosher, as I mentioned, goes to the non-kosher trade, so therefore the kosher distributor does not... they have a loss, and so therefore they can, it's much easier for them to deal only with the glatt kosher.
We have two comments on the chat, and the first one is that if the Ashkenazim were to start asking for Beit Yosef, the demand would go up and so would the price. And so he feels it would be wrong to be stringent on someone else's account, that it's going to, for those that would require the Beit Yosef, the prices would go up because it would be more demand.
Yeah, that's definitely a valid point.
Okay, so that's a good point. The other comment we have is that question is, would the price of meat go down if we allow just regular kosher meat? What do you think of that?
Well, the price of kosher meat is cheaper than glatt kosher meat because when you're dealing with kosher, you have 70% kosher, you know, opposed to 35% glatt kosher. So therefore... the expenses which you have, you know, flying in shechtim and paying for the shechita, etc., that is spread over more animals, and so therefore the price is definitely less than on the glatt kosher meat. But it all depends on what the consumer wants. If the consumers will all say we want only kosher, and kosher is available, so then if there's an abundance of the supply and demand, if there's abundance of glatt kosher, so then the price will go down also. But I don't think that's happening so fast, because most of the people who are eating kosher meat nowadays want the glatt kosher, and there's not really such a big market for the kosher among Jewish people. There are Muslims and other people who like to eat kosher, and they are the biggest consumer, the biggest buyers of the regular glatt meat, for example, Hebrew National, according to my understanding.
Regular non-glatt, you mean?
Right, regular kosher, non-glatt.
Right.
Hebrew National, 80% of their products are sold to non-Jews. It seems like it's not in high demand among Jewish customers.
Right. You know, what we should also point out that, the word glad has taken a broader meaning, and sometimes even chickens are referred to as glad, even though that doesn't really apply. And I know that when I go on Continental from Israel to back to America, I have to order, in order to get the level of kosher that I want, I have to order glot. They call it glot. That doesn't mean that their regular kosher is not glot, but that's the way they call super kosher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it takes on a broader meaning, that just glot means very kosher.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, we do find a lot of caterers, especially in the New York area, that are really they use glad kosher meat, but they are only considered kosher caterers because there are a lot of other processes that are involved, both in the processing of the meat, for example, the salting, etc., and also making sure that nothing is done on Shabbos. So the caterers are only kosher. They might be cooking on Shabbos and doing other things which are not permitted. They feel that it does not affect the status of their food, but they cannot call it glad kosher because it's not the way it's supposed to be.
We're speaking with Rabbi Shmuel Heineman of Lakewood, New Jersey, and I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg. We're brought to you by kosherclasses.org. Again, if you have any questions, you can chat them to us or hit 1-1 on your keypad if you're joining us by the telephone. I want to turn the conversation a little bit, Rabbi Heineman, to the actual slaughtering process without getting too gory. What's it like to be a shochet, a slaughterer on site there? What are some of the challenges that he has to deal with, besides the fact that it may be way out in the middle of nowhere and he's away from home for a while? What are some of the issues that they're dealing with? So give appreciation of what it means to get that kosher meat to your plate.
Well, you know, slaughtering of an animal is not a clean business. You know, the person who's the shechet, who's slaughtering the animal, gets himself filthy with the blood when he shechs the animal. It was a time when it was really a dangerous occupation because often the animal, after the shechita, still is able to move around, and if it's not correctly restrained, it could be dangerous for the shechet. But nowadays, with the new machinery we have, that's not a problem anymore. The animal is completely restrained, and there's no danger for the shechet at all. It's just it's not a clean job because you get yourself all dirty. But the responsibility that the shechet has is a tremendous responsibility because he has to make sure that his knife is razor sharp without any niches or any variations in the blade, to make sure that that the cut is done fast and painlessly to the animal. And it's his responsibility to make sure, besides that the knife is sharp and without any blemishes, that he's doing the shechita in the right place, and he doesn't stop in the middle, and he doesn't push down too hard. Or there's so many other rules which the shechet has to keep in mind. Every time he does a shechita, there are just about almost 40 chapters, simanim and shulchan aruch, of what he has to keep in mind when he does the shechita, that it's a tremendous responsibility. And
how many animals are usually slaughtered in an hour by an individual shochet?
Okay, and on beef, it all depends on the size of the slaughterhouse. There are some slaughterhouses that only will shecht 12 an hour, and there are some slaughterhouses which there'll be much more. You could have 50 or 60 or even 100 an hour, but in those situations, there would be more than one shochet. It all depends on how the slaughterhouse is set up, and that determines the speed of how many he can shecht.
Okay, so we can't make a general rule. I think we have another question through the telephone. Let's take that. Go ahead.
Hi, this is a question from before on the glot versus the regular kosher. Would a respected rabbi be a mashgiach at a restaurant that serves the regular kosher meat?
Okay, the question is, would a respected Orthodox rabbi give a certification on a restaurant that serves regular kosher as opposed to glatt? That's a good question.
Okay. Presently, I'm not aware of any meat that is, with the shchita, is only kosher, not glatt, which has a respectable certification. As I mentioned earlier, that just about all the major organizations only shecht glatt. So therefore, if this restaurant has only kosher, you really have to know where it came from. And if it comes from a reputable shochet and it actually is a kosher done correctly, so then there really would be nothing wrong with it. But it's really very hard to find nowadays an animal that the shchita was kosher, not glatt, that is really up to the standard of kosher as it was 45 years ago.
So your answer basically is no, it would not really be possible that respected or a recognized rabbi organization would give a certification on a non-glatt restaurant. Is that your answer?
Pretty much, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. So let's get back to the slaughterhouse. Let's talk a little bit about the chicken. How fast is the chicken slaughtering?
Okay. Now, again, as I mentioned by the beef, the same thing really applies to the chickens also. It all depends on the system. You can have a shechet that's shechting 10 a minute, and it's too fast for him. And you can have in another slaughterhouse where he's shechting 20 a minute, and he's not being rushed at all.
Exaggerating with the 10 a minute?
Yes. No, I'm not exaggerating. For example, in Eretz Yisrael, when they shech the chicken, the shechet himself holds the whole chicken himself. He's not assisted by any other helper. So the shaykh has to pick up the chicken, hold it, that it shouldn't flap around, then grab the neck, and then do the shchita. And if he can do 10 a minute, he's doing very fast. And it might even be too fast for him. However, in America, all the shchitas of chicken, every shaykh is assisted by at least two workers who will hold the chicken, and all he has to do is hold the neck and move his knife back and forth, which takes a split second. So therefore, in America, it's possible for a shechet really to shecht 20 a minute, and it would not be a problem, and he would actually be relaxed while he's doing the shechita.
20 a minute is one every 3 seconds.
Let me just finish off. Generally, in America, the shechet does not shecht more than 12 a minute, which comes out to 720 an hour. That is the general accepted speed.
Once every 5 seconds.
Right.
I've seen that, and when it sounds very fast, how can you shecht a chicken in 5 seconds? But when you actually see it, for most of those 5 seconds, he's not really doing anything. Is that right?
That's what I remember from the times
I went to see you, Shrita.
Right.
Because he's waiting for the next animal to be brought to him. The movement of the knife takes half a second.
Right. That's correct. It takes a split second. And all he has to do is grab the neck and move his knife back and forth, which grabbing the neck and the actual shchita takes him maybe 1 second. And he's not rushed. If you see someone shechting, you'd realize how relaxed he is and not rushed. Since he has so many people helping him, he's not bothered by any of the other preparations or holding of the chicken or putting the chicken down after he shechts it. It's all done by other people, and therefore he's not rushed at all, and it is actually very slow. 12 a minute is actually a very slow process for shechting. But that is generally the accepted speed in most of the chicken slaughterhouses in America.
Now, you went down recently to Mexico to oversee some slaughtering over there also, to set it up, I believe, right?
Yeah, that is correct. Since Rubashkin, which is the largest supply of meat and poultry in America, was closed down a little bit more than a year ago, everyone thought at that time there would be a major shortage of meat in America. What has happened since that time is that a lot of other people have decided to jump in and fill the void, And the place where Rubashkin was, there are now maybe six or seven new processes of meat and mostly meat products, and therefore they have filled the void, and there actually is an abundance of meat presently in America. We had a request from a distributor in Mexico who wanted our supervision, and his plan was not only to supply the Mexican market, but also in Mexico, they're mostly Sfardim, or the religious ones are mostly Sfardim, and therefore they were using only the Beis Yosef, as we mentioned before, Glad. And so what we shecht their Beis Yosef is for Mexico, and the regular Glad, and the Glad meat that they're looking to send to America, and therefore that has been a new avenue of a source of meat to come to America also.
Now, I don't think people realize how big the community is down there, the Jewish community that eats kosher. How many Jews in Mexico are looking for kosher meat?
I don't really know how many buy kosher, but they say that in Mexico, basically most of the Jews live in Mexico City, there are approximately 40,000 Jews there. Most of the Jews there are of Ashkenazic origin, but the religious Jews are mostly of Sephardic origin. And so therefore, the custom in Mexico City has been basically only to sell the Beis Yosef Glad to satisfy the Sephardim who require that it should only be Beis Yosef.
Is there any difference between setting up a slaughterhouse in Mexico or in Idaho or in Mifflinton, Pennsylvania, or anywhere else? Is there any difference, or it's basically you're dealing with the same issues? You have this, you have the shochtim, you have the chickens or meat, you have, you have to do the same halachic process. Is there anything that's different? Maybe because of different laws or different approaches?
Well, the slaughterhouse which we're dealing with in Mexico is a USDA-approved slaughterhouse. Mexico is...
That means you have the USDA there in Mexico?
They don't have the USDA there, but it is approved by the USDA to ship to America. Mexico really is a third-world country, and I've been there for Shkita many years ago, and it's not really as sophisticated in most places as it is... in most places in Mexico as it is here in America. So, therefore, it does have its challenges. But this particular slaughterhouse which we're in right now... which we're certifying, that is a very modern, up-to-date slaughterhouse. It's more modern than most slaughterhouses, even in America. And really, the truth of the matter is that dealing with the people in Mexico is really a pleasure because they're out to please. They want the business, and they do whatever you ask for, whatever you request, they'll do, because I guess they need the business. In America, you don't always have that cooperation.
That's what I gathered from what you were saying, that it's not always like that.
Right.
But the USDA is not there, and yet they allow the meat into the United States. So based on what? Who? What? Is there any government? I know here in the United States, when you have when you go to a slaughterhouse, you have an inspector there who is working the line together with the regular mashkichim and the supervisors and the kosher, they work together with them. But so is there any governmental agency at all there in Mexico? It's just that the USDA came or comes from time to time to check it out. Where does that work?
Well, basically the USDA has certain rules and regulations, what they require, how the plant is set up and the cleanliness of the plant and what the walls and the floors are made out of. There shouldn't be any bacteria, how fast you have to cool down the animal, etc. They want to make sure there's no bacteria and everything is done correctly. Besides that, they have certain regulations on the animal itself to make sure that it's fit for human consumption, it doesn't have any diseases. This particular plant has a Mexican governmental supervision, which is called TIF, T-I-F, and that organization has the same standards, if not greater standards, higher standards than the USDA. And so, therefore, basically, the USDA is relying on this, on the TIF inspectors in Mexico to make sure that it meets their standards.
But the TIF inspector is not on site.
They do have inspectors on site.
They do? Okay.
Yes. It's a very modern plant. To tell you the truth, it's more modern than most plants I've been to in America, and I've been to many of them.
Because I was thinking if there's no USDA there, then that would be an incentive for producers of meat to go outside the United States. That way they don't have to pay for the inspector. But because in America you have to pay the salary of the inspector, right?
No.
So they have to pay for that inspector.
No, the inspectors.
Who pays the inspector?
No, the government pays the inspector. It's government funded. It's run by the government. They're afraid if the company will pay the inspector. It's like same regulation we have with Mashgichim. If the owner pays the Mashgichim, so the Mashgichim will feel obligated to the owner. If the agency pays the Mashgichim, so then they just have to do what they're supposed to do, and they don't take into consideration the owner at all. The same thing with the meat processing plants and anything which is government regulated. If the company is going to pay the inspector, the inspectors will do what the company wants. If the government is paying the inspectors, they do not take the company into consideration at all, often to extremes, and they'll close down the company for a slight minor infractions because they are not beholden to the company at all. And so therefore, companies in America do not pay the inspector. The only time they have to pay an inspector is if they work overtime. So then not during regular hours, more than 8 hours a day, or if they work on weekends, then they have to pay the inspector, whatever it is, time and a half.
Okay. We do have another question through the telephone. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. How often does the USDA recertify the plant?
How often does the USDA recertify the plant, Herman?
That's a good question. To tell you the truth, I don't know. This plant is a relatively new plant. It just received its certification to ship to America a few months ago, so I don't know when it's up for renewal. That's a good question, so I cannot answer.
Okay, we could find that out if you want to. If the caller wants to get back in touch with us, we could look into that.
Yeah.
If anybody has any questions, again, you hit 1-1 on your keypad, or you can chat on the dim-dim with us. And, okay, I think we pretty much covered the many areas, Rabbi Heinemann, on the meat issue. Is there anything else that you think is important for our listeners to know?
I don't really think we covered everything. We really have just scratched the surface. The meat industry is very large, and there's so much that goes in besides the actual shechita. After the shechita, there's the soaking and the salting, and before that, the deveining, and there's so much that's involved with the correct labeling and the correct sealing of the product to make sure that you're actually getting a klat kosher product that goes into it. And that is really one of the reasons why people always ask, why is glatt kosher meat or meat and kosher meat in general is more expensive than regular meat? And the answer to that is that there's so much expenses involved in the preparation of the meat besides the actual growing of the meat and chicken, which, for example, chickens that are produced for kosher slaughter have to have a special kosher diet, not because the chickens have to eat kosher, but this way make sure that there are no problems of diseases in the chicken, and also when they flick the chickens to take off the feathers, if they don't have the right feed, it will rip the skin and it won't come out a nice product. There's so much involved that causes the price to be higher than regular chickens and beef. But basically, the shechita in America is on a much higher standard than it was years ago. There's much, we have much more clout with the companies, and therefore, if you're buying a product which has a reliable hashgacha, one which you know, which your rabbi tells you can rely on, you can be sure that you're getting a quality and kosher product on a high standard.
Okay, so then on that note, Rabbi Heinemann, we will close the teleconference. I want to remind everybody that this is a monthly conference. We're here on the last... What's that? Zev wants me to remind everybody this is recorded, and that you can get the recording on our Kosher Classes site. That's kosher, kosher.org, and you click over there on, I think it's called podcast, and you can get this this recording if you want to tell your friends about it. And this is a monthly conference, the last Wednesday of each month. And we appreciate that you joined us today. We had a nice participation. We have some people chatting to us. Thank you. So that goes to you, Rabbi Heineman. Thank you for your time. And we look forward to seeing everybody next month.
Yeah,
have a very good day.
It was a pleasure. And maybe we'll continue at a different time once.
Okay. There is much to talk about. We can definitely... move on in the meat issues and or other issues with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, all the best.
Be well, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.